The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Umberto Eco, was recorded at the British Library, London in November 2015. Hosting the event, The Guardian's John Mullen.
Thank you very much, and welcome on your behalf to Umberto. This is his only British gig, this is it, okay? And he's chosen us. He's chosen to give us his presence and his benediction. And we're talking about his new novel, Numero Zero. How do I pronounce it?
Numero Zero.
That's okay. And in just a second, I am going to try to give a little description of the novel. Okay, and then you correct me.
It's very short.
Yes, well, yeah, but quite complicated. And you can correct me if I get it wrong.
Okay.
Okay, and then I
it's
will
my,
ask...
It's my job to correct yes. people. It's, yeah. It's your job too.
No, I am a... My wife calls me stooge to the
I mean
star.
In the university.
Oh, I'm in the university, yeah, but I'm not... Unfortunately, I'm not... I don't... I've vested... That authority is gone. But first of all, I should say... That if you will indulge me for a second, this is a big moment for me because 30 years ago, when I was a PhD student, it was the only other time I've been in the same room as Umberto. He doesn't remember it, funnily enough, but I do. And I was right at the back of a sort of seminar room, and I was in those days thinking maybe I could try to become an academic. And I saw this man, he came from Italy, he was very charming, he was very successful, he was very humorous, and I thought, yes, that's a role model, not one I've quite fulfilled, unfortunately. And I remember there was the room was full of Cambridge academics, very, very serious and earnest. And they were a bit worried because this academic had written a novel, and more than this, it was a novel that millions of people had read. And one of them asked a question, and he said, you have written about semiotics and literary theory and literary analysis, but also you write a novel. How is it possible for somebody who is an analyst of literature also to enjoy writing fiction? And Umberto said, even... a gynecologist falls in love. It's good. But as I remember it, don't worry, the story's ended now. But as
he's saying that I am very, very old.
As I remember it, Umberto said this wonderful line, and half the people in the Cambridge University seminar room laughed. But half of them looked a little bit puzzled. Anyway.
They were gynecologists, probably.
maybe so. So I'm going to try to describe the Numero Zero now. It is, I always say to the students, first person or third person? Start there. It is narrated in the first person by somebody who did not finish their PhD. Called Colonna. Is that how you pronounce
not
it?
Not even BA.
No. He's a loser.
A loser.
And he has some journalistic and writing experience, and he is hired to do two things. First of all, to contribute to a newspaper domani, tomorrow, today, sorry, today.
Tomorrow.
And this newspaper does not really exist. It is a trick, a device. And a very rich man wants to fabricate this newspaper to show it to people even more powerful than himself, to persuade them that he has the power to introduce stories and scandal threatening to them, to the public. And so if they don't want this newspaper to appear, they must admit him to the inner sanctum of power in Italy. Yes, is that roughly
right? The good milieu, yes. The good circle. In Italian, it's salotto buono. The good dining room.
Where the people of power really get together. But also, the man who has hired him says, you are also writing a book about this newspaper, and this book will be my memoir. You are a ghostwriter. And it will reflect very well in me because it will describe my heroic efforts to my heroic but unsuccessful efforts to produce a newspaper that tells the truth. So he has two jobs, yes? And, I mean, am I right so far?
So far, okay.
So maybe...
But they're only the first five pages.
It is a full and respectful synopsis. Maybe we could start before I bore everybody here by much more of my synopsis, by you telling me why this situation interests you, why this setup that I have described.
Well, for many reasons. One is that since 30 years I was writing essays on the flows of journalism. From inside I write on newspapers and magazines, but so it was a constant preoccupation of mine. Then I was also always fascinated by plots, by the paranoia of plots. And my novel like Foucault's Pendulum is like that, and the Prague Cemetery is about all the anti-Semitic plots and so on and so forth. And here there is a plot. You have not mentioned it, but there is a paranoid character whose name, curiously, for an English person is Braggadocio, because in English you know that there is in Spencer or
Fairy Queen.
While in the rest of the world not, but Braggadocio was in the list of the fonts of word. Then it disappeared. All the characters have names that are fonts.
Are fonts, right.
Colonna, Lucidis,
Palatino.
Yes. Also because my
You're
first...
You're getting the analytical tools
my first, here. My first novel, I didn't realize it, but the character is the name of a font, Baskerville.
Oh, yes.
So in all my novels, I gave names of fonts. And Braggadocio is a paranoid who invents a plot according to which all the disasters, all the conspiracies, all the booms that blew up in Italy, really, because all the rest of the book speaks of real facts, he thought that it depends on the fact that Mussolini was not killed in 45, but it was still living in Argentina, as every Nazi, to prepare a return. Okay, so there is the idea of the plot is also there. I am obsessed by the plot, so that I invented this definition, all the paranoids persecute me.
And you have... Is that your interest in plots and conspiracy theories? Is that why the very first thing we find in the novel is the epigraph, which everybody will remember from, I'm sure, from Howard's End, from E.M. Forster's Howard's End, the epigraph, it says, only connect. But only connect in Forster, it says, only connect, dot, dot, dot. But in your novel, it says, only connect, exclamation mark.
No, I am a philosopher. I write novels only on the weekends. And as a philosopher, even though this looks pretty traditionalist, I am interested in truth. Since it's very difficult to decide what is true or not, I discovered that it's easier to arrive to truth through the analysis of fakes. So that I am always being interested in fakes. So plots are only a subchapter. Even as a old books collector, I am collecting only books that are wrong. So I have not Galileo, but I have Ptolemy.
Ah.
Because he was wrong, unfortunately. And so I have all the books on conspiracy, all the invented languages. So that, provided it's fake, I collect it even if it is. So that's why.
Right, okay. And you have also this interest that you have in this new novel, but which is there in some of your other novels as well, of when things which are fakes, which are invented, become real. And without giving anything away, Braggadocio, his conspiracy invention or theory...
But at a certain point, he is killed.
Yes.
And so
nobody he's telling
knows
you, he's giving you. But... No, I was trying to keep the murder secret, but no. but he's killed.
Nobody knows why. I would say that the 50% or more of the public opinion is shaped by fakes. Tell the last chapter, they invented, probably for political reasons, that the Pope had the cancer to the brain, in order to say that everything he said was unreliable. It was a fake with 99%, but it is on the verge of becoming true.
Yeah.
A common opinion. So we are blackmailed by fakes.
Uh-huh. And I mean, maybe the fake story, which I think is the only, am I right, the only story about events in the world in the book which is not true is the one that Mussolini did not die.
So
all the rest is
unfortunately.
And to me, perhaps partly because I'm not Italian, but maybe because I'm badly informed too, most of these stories were entirely new. And this is a novel which sends you off to Google a lot. Yeah, I mean in a good way. You think,
yes,
here's a story about a. There's a conversation about a man who lived in Milan in the 19th century, and he took people down into his cellar and he hacked them to pieces after doing financial swindles to get their money. And you Google it, and there is a picture of him. He was there.
But you don't need Google, because you have never been in Troy, but you can read the Iliad pretty well. I mean, a book is able to tell everything is fundamental for understanding the situation. Then if you go to Google, okay, it's a way to keep more informed. But I know we don't know Macondo, but if you read 100 Years of Solitude, you understand everything about this place. So,
but the story about, you were talking about Mussolini, you have in your book an incredible story, which is true, evidently, about how, and perhaps you'd like to share it, because it's quite important to the book, about how Mussolini's body, or for the characters in the book, Mussolini's double's body, was dug up 11 years after he died by a fascist enthusiast.
We're losing pieces.
Who had left a leg behind or something, yeah?
Yes.
This is incredible. This happened.
Yes, this happened. That's true.
And why did this man, who I think only died a few years ago, the man... What was his name, the man who dug it up?
Yes, I don't remember. My Alzheimer is...
No, my Alzheimer's too. Domenico Lecchisi.
Lecchisi.
Yes.
Yes, it was a deputy then in the parliament.
He became an MP after he did this, yeah.
And but, you know, because every cult needs a corpse.
Yes.
It's the story of relics during the centuries. You needed to have the finger of Saint Bababu. So they need a corpse to a corpse in order to have a body.
Yeah.
I mean, and every dictator made a lot in order to build up his own body, the body of Mussolini with a naked working, the body of Berlusconi,
yeah,
which is cyborg. His head, it is remade day by day, but the body is fundamental, yeah. Is fundamental. And so when you have no longer the body, you need the corpse,
yeah,
at any cost.
Yeah. I mean, the extraordinary thing about these stories that you include in the novel is that whilst Braggadocio is a bit crazy to believe this story, the other stories that are true,
yeah,
when they are stitched together in the novel, I start thinking, so there was a conspiracy. Because they are incredible stories of Gladio, were you like, and because this is...
It didn't happen only in Italy, also, yeah, in Spain, in France, yeah. I don't know, in UK, but it was a European phenomenon.
Can you tell everybody about the Gladio thing, which is an incredible story?
Immediately after, you can find, go to internet and you have all the documentation. Immediately after the Second World War, when there was the reversement of the alliance, they had not to fight against the Nazis, but against the Russians. So they tried, in order to stop a possible invasion of Europe, to establish in Europe a sort of secret society with weapon, with people that were trained to make a sort of partisan war. And in order to have people ready to shoot, as I said, they had to enroll even old fascists. And then continued to work until the fall of the Russian Empire. At that point, it was no longer necessary. And somebody in Italy, the president of the Republic, they said, oh, yes, okay, there was Gladio. But Gladio was operating all... In the whole Europe, and nobody knew it. Now you go to internet, you have names, places, everything, with secret services, obviously, yeah, as usual, involved. And it's a fascinating story, and it is true. But you know, there was a book in French, in the 50s, entitled "La réalité dépasse la fiction." Reality is
stranger than fiction.
Stranger than fiction. In all my novels, I used a lot of real facts that were believed to be an invention of mine, but in the island of the day before, there is a strange machine for observing the satellites of Jupiter, which is very, very, very comic. It was invented and described by Galileo. They tried to sell it to the Dutch, and he didn't succeed, okay, because it was absolutely crazy. But there is the text. Yeah. When you tell it as a story, you laugh.
Yeah.
This reality is fascinating because it's more inventive, yeah, than fiction.
It's incredible. I mean, there's sort of, and there's a Masonic lodge, of course, and there are secret societies, and I mean, it makes the Da Vinci Code look very, very poor stuff, doesn't it? The real thing.
He's one of my characters.
Yes.
He's a character of my Foucault's Pendulum, because it takes seriously everything I was representing in a grotesque... I told him, you are one of my characters.
You tell Dan Brown that. Yeah. And how did he respond to
that? Well, he smiled. As a good character of mine.
And I'm before... While we're still with the various conspiracies, I hadn't realized some of these things are, you know, these are things from my lifetime, that there is even a planned coup d'etat in 1970 against the Italian state.
Yes, with a force of the armies, the Milizia Forestale, those who were concerned with woods, protection of, and it was prepared until the end. At a certain moment, it happened something, phone call, and they stopped.
Right.
And we know the names, who was there, who was leading them. Some of them escaped to Spain at the time there was still Franco there. And nobody knows why it stopped. Probably because they realized that they were not really prepared. Or another power told them, please, stop. Anyway, but until, let's say, 9 o'clock, they were ready to, 9:15, it was out. Another fictional story.
And if they hadn't stopped, what would have happened?
Pardon?
If they had not stopped, would they have been successful?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so, because the boss was a fanatic, former fascist, able to use a gun, but not to conceive a big operation like that.
Right. Okay. And do you think? I mean, one of your characters, the main female character, Maya, says
the only one.
The only one. Yes. Says about Italians. She says, "We've always been a people of daggers and poison."
But not she. Is current idea in the foreign countries.
But so she is making fun of people's opinion of Italy rather than
yes.
She's
trying to say why that happened. But I can mention many other countries full of daggers and poisons. Even
there
were kings that killed their own wife in certain countries.
I was wondering if in the particular period, though, that this novel covers, which is since the Second World War, if there are some aspects of Italian public life which make it better material for these conspiracy stories than other countries.
Considering what happened in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, yes, Italy was a good period for telling a story like that. Not as far as the conspiracies, the paranoia of conspiracy, because if you go to internet, you see how many American sites are full. The American didn't go to the moon.
Yes.
The Twin Towers were destroyed by the Jews, by Bush. So it's full, the obsession of conspiracies. But as far as real conspiracies were, because I am not denying that conspiracies exist. Simply, the real ones are discovered, even though they succeed or if they do not succeed. Take the assassination of a Julius Caesar was a conspiracy. It was a success. It was well known. The conspiracy of Catilina was a conspiracy. It didn't succeed, and it was immediately discovered. The gunpowder was a conspiracy. So the real conspiracies are always discovered. The powerful ones are the ones which do not exist, so you cannot demonstrate that they are not there, so they continue to float in the public mind, and they can nourish a lot of naive people who really believe that the American didn't go to the moon. I have the scientific proof that they went there. The scientific proof is that the only ones who could discover that they didn't go were the Russians. The Russians didn't say anything, so it means that it means that they really went there.
I was wondering also, I mean, you're right, the 9/11 one, I think, is very, very... I was shocked to discover that one of my teenage children, she is 15, and she seems to have many friends at school who think that they are, you know, and not necessarily they believe the conspiracy theory, but they think they are very sophisticated because they don't believe the official account. They don't believe
My grandchild told me that some of his friends are trying to read about conspiracies in internet, and they think that probably the Twin Towers were, you know, that it was also said that they were the Jews, and then the day before the Jews working that it
were,
on the contrary, there were at least 300 Jews dead. The idea that there were no Jews in the towers still. You know that the only safe one were black women, because they were the last to smoke in the United States, and so they were outside smoking.
No, I didn't know that. Right. Okay. So, smokers. Vindicated yet again, yeah. I mean, I was just thinking about, both in real life, but also in your novel, conspiracy the relationship in your writing between conspiracy theories and narrative and storytelling. And when you listen to Braggadocio, when Colina, your narrator, listens to him, you can hear how pleasing conspiracy theories are. Because you can tell a wonderful story.
Otherwise, they couldn't be convincing.
Yes. Yeah, but it also is the pleasure of narrative, isn't it, in a way?
Yes, it was my pleasure of narratives. Due to the curious facts of my childhood, I was 13 years old when the things happened, when Mussolini was executed. But later, I became a friend of the man who arrested him, because he was the brother-in-law of Luciano Berio, the great musician. So I met him. So I met the man who arrested Mussolini. When it was discovered, or there was a sort of coming out from the Communist Party saying that the man who killed Mussolini was Colonnello Valerio, we discovered that it was living in my city. And my father said, "Oh, yes, but I know him. I met him every day on the corner, and we were not... you know this kind of... You know this man because you see him every day, you say, how are you?"
Yes.
So the man who arrested Mussolini and the man who killed him belonged to my adolescence. And so I elaborate a story of which, in a way, I was a minor protagonist.
How incredible. I mean, it's like that. I find it extraordinary that that man who stole the body continued to be a sort of character who appeared in the news and also kept all his beliefs, did he not? He remained a fascist.
And a
devotee of
Mussolini.
Let me ask.
In this sense, he was very coherent.
Yes.
He didn't change his mind.
The novel, where we started with, I was describing how it was narrated. I wonder if you could say something about who you have chosen to tell the story, because obviously this is an important, you know, just as with the Name of the Rose, it is very important that it is narrated by Adso, who is like Dr. Watson, say. You have chosen, we said, this loser, this man, slightly man without qualities, a little bit. A man without...
Absolutely, Musilian.
Yes. why did that seem
because,
the right thing to do?
That's literature. Dostoevsky was writing about losers. The main character of the Iliad, Hector, is a loser. It's very boring to tell about winners. The real literature speaks always of losers. Madame Bovary is a loser. Julien Sorel of Le Rouge et Le Noir is a loser. So I am in the Sillon, in the way of literature. Well, I'm doing always the same job. Losers are more fascinating than winners. Say, winners are stupid. Also because usually they win by chance.
Yes.
They are not responsible of their victory.
But also one of your characters says something interesting, that winners are people who concentrate on knowing one thing, and losers, like autodidacts, always know much more than winners. The pleasures of erudition are reserved for losers.
Yeah. Don't identify the opinions of the characters with the opinions of the writer. Otherwise, Shakespeare would be one who was ready to give his horse for his kingdom for a horse. But in a way, having worked in a publishing house for years and having to do with some collaborators, correctors of proofs, they were enormously erudite.
Yes.
They knew everything, but in a disconnected way. In a sense, the real scholar is focused on something. Then it happened in the United States that it is so much focused that he ignores all the rest, but it is a national disease. Anyway, while the loser and the autodidact, can know all the history of the world and to ignore the existence of Charlemagne.
Yes.
Because there was a hole in this point. So my character belongs to this. So I think that the only positive character is Maya.
Yes.
The girl who is full of humor and doesn't believe to what happens.
Yeah, I think he's lucky to get her.
Huh?
I think Colina's lucky to get her. Do you not think? I mean, he hardly does.
Colonna
is lucky to get Maya.
Yes.
Hardly deserves that. Yeah. And what you were saying about the person who knows a lot, it's very familiar to me in the academic world, where I think it is very common that I remember a man who was in my department, who is dead now, is a wonderful man called Tim Langley, and he never published any books. And the people at the top of the university were saying, what is he doing? And he knew everything. He read everything. He knew seven languages. He knew literature from Beowulf to the present day.
Yes, and they have the cramp. I have some friends like that.
Yes.
They know so much that they have a sort of paralysis when they have to write. But the idea of Colonna was a friend of mine who knew the German so well that he couldn't do anything else. So he didn't graduate. He didn't graduate because of the German.
He's too busy translating. Your character translates the most sort of obscure and difficult.
That was my friend. Yeah. He lost a lot of time in translating because at that time to know German was it's like today to know Chinese. Yes. You're a specialist, and so he didn't graduate.
And you also give through your narrator, as we've mentioned, a very your narrator has a very cynical knowledge of journalism and of journalistic practice, which he teaches to others, yes? And he teaches them how to turn opinions into facts. He teaches them how readers prefer cliches. He teaches them how to denigrate a victim very subtly. How to make the fact that he goes to a Chinese restaurant.
It happened to me.
It happened to you.
It happened to me.
You went to a Chinese restaurant.
A newspaper who obviously didn't like me said, yesterday, Professor Eco has been found in a Chinese restaurant with an unknown person eating with sticks. And it is the same restaurant where it goes frequently, Guido Rossi, a very important person in Milan. Stop. So it was absolutely true. But imagine that obviously in Milano, Rome, Bologna, there are a lot of Chinese restaurants, but in the villages of Italy. So the idea of somebody who goes with a Chinese restaurant makes Dr. Fu Manchu. No, and with an unknown person. It was unknown to the journalist, not to me. It was a friend of mine. It was a friend of mine. And the fact that Guido Rossi went to the same restaurant is because both we were living 100 meters from that Chinese restaurant. So it was, you can try to kill a person by telling the truth. Simply establishing a sort of, suggesting a sort of suspicion. Yeah. Why in a Chinese world? Why doesn't eat spaghetti like every honest Italian and so on?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very interesting thing about the novel, because you say suspicion, and it seems to me a novel in which suspicion is very important and can be either a very good and necessary thing. We should be suspicious of what we're told without evidence, but can be a very bad thing. We're suspicious, we are made suspicious of people by completely trivial and incidental things.
That's paranoia.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned all the tricks invented by Colonna in order to make up a bad newspaper. Somebody has suggested to use my book in the schools of journalism in order to understand what shouldn't be done, what shouldn't be done. And some great Italian journalists like Eugenio Scalfari, the founder of Repubblica, or Paolo Mieli, who directed the Corriere della Sera, they talked with me about that story. And they say, okay, we are making different newspaper, but some of the things you tell are concerning also the great newspapers.
Yes. The good ones.
Even the good ones.
Okay, I mean, I think it's time. I could go on, but I won't. I won't, because I want to give everybody here a chance to ask questions. We've got a couple of mics going round. So if you'd like to ask something or say something, if you put your hand up and I'll pick... Oh, gentleman here who plays for Wales at rugby.
Not really.
Sorry?
Not really.
Not really.
You never talks about all the very bad facts that happened in Italy between...
Oh, about?
The
about
bad,
the bad facts that happened in Italy.
That happened in Italy between the 50s and the 90s, I suppose. So said that it wasn't Mussolini who did it. And don't you think it was that kind of way of thinking that followed after Mussolini was killed, who built up all this stay behind and Gladio thing?
What kind of way of thinking do you mean, sir?
Right wing. Kind of fascist thinking, kind of ideas of not doing what they didn't do with the Golpe Borghese, but trying to keep Italy on the right hand side rather than on the left hand side.
Obviously, yes. But that had nothing to do with the story of the body of Mussolini, because nobody in Italy said that Mussolini was not killed. The evidence was so evident that didn't... but all the rest, yes, okay.
The fascists persisted. There was a... So why were the fascists...
I don't smoke. It's 12 years I don't smoke any longer.
Yeah.
Chew.
You chew.
I chew. Like the old man that then spit continuously. Yeah.
I think we're all cool with chewing. Yeah. why was there that persistence of fascist influence that the gentleman asked about?
But because after the war, with the partisan war, there was the legend that the Italian people was reacting against the dictatorship. It is untrue. They accepted it. They accepted it until the last moment, according to Ennio Flaiano, then Italian are used always to help the winner, but they accepted it. And even recently somebody said, there is, in any case, the 51% of Italians who are rightists. That's why the everything happens like it happened. And so that's is useful or irrelevant to try to make people to change their opinion. That was, but tell La France profonde, the majority of the French population outside Paris are still still very traditionalist. And so it happens.
There's a gentleman
right
there.
Italians accepted the fascism. But I see my family, they were not fascist. They were listening Radio Londra, okay. We have a cousin who was a socialist, and when coming to our place, making enormous protestation against us, so that my family, please don't speak aloud. But they accepted many jokes about fascism, but at the end they accepted the situation. It was easier to accept it.
Sir?
Buonasera. You've famously written about narrative structure in Ian Fleming. I don't know how you feel about the numerous writers who've tried to write James Bond stories since. I wondered whether you had ever considered following Numero Zero with 007, or whether Bond is too much of a winner for you.
No, yes, obviously Bond was a winner. I hope you have not read my analysis of Fleming in the first English edition of the Bond case, because it was an unreliable translation. Then I re-translated it into an older English book that was The Role of the Reader, and then it was republished in many others. But the first English translation was horrible. Anyway, I was interested first not in the movies, but in the stories and in the narrative technique of Fleming. So James Bond is not one of my heroes. Also because he drinks a false martini. He wants it shakered and not mixed, which is absolutely the contrary. This is blasphemy.
Isn't a James Bond, isn't he also supposed to be a rather horrible person?
Hmm? Well,
isn't James Bond in the books,
yes,
supposed to be not very nice person? And that is part of the...
Less hero than in the movies. Yeah. Also because he's not so beautiful like as Sean Connery, obviously. We made a lot in order to create the myth of James Bond. But sometimes one of the novels starts with James Bond was sitting in the lounge of the Miami airport with the double martini inside him and thinking of life and death, which is beautiful. So he had in the novels he had some moment of philosophical reflections. In the movies he had not time to do that.
There's a lady here and a lady.
There's another bestseller at the moment which deals with fascism, and that's this book, He's Back Again. It does not deal with Mussolini, but with Hitler. And it's not about the parts of his body, but it's the complete resurrection of Hitler. And that seems to be quite fashionable at the moment, resurrection in Germany. The year before they had a story about Christ being resurrected and going into restaurants and convincing people to share their food with the poor. And now we've got this other resurrection. What would you say? Is that a special northern version as opposed to the southern version of having parts of the dead body?
Do you understand? Yeah. You've got that?
More or less. In any case, the story of Hitler is... rather different from that of Mussolini, because Mussolini, we have witnesses immediately after the death that the corpse was transported to Piazzale Loreto, then there was an autopsy, and then there was all the story of those travels of the body. While with Hitler, we don't have anything, so because he burned out, if he burned out, if not, he went... and so the mystery can remain. What have said the Russians? So you can have more literature on the further life of Hitler than on that of Mussolini. There is a very nice joke according to which Hitler is still living in Argentina now. It should be dead in any case, but at that time the joke was so. And the new Nazi went to him and said, "We have to return." And he said, "No, I'm too old. No, no, you have to. No, but please let me." No, then he's convinced. He says, "Okay, I come, but this time, very bad, isn't it?" Cattivi.
But it's quite a lot of novels, I think, where Hitler's alive, I think. But anyway, please.
My question regards translation, because your English is perfect. So how closely do you work with a translator on the novels, for example?
How I work with translators?
How closely do you work with
them? My English is not so good. You are flattering me. Anyway. One time a person told me something horrible. You are saying, and I said, "Ma'am, you are flattering me." I work with my translators always. Not only as far as the languages I know are concerned, so I can control English, French, Spanish, and German with my wife, who is German. But I worked very well also with the Russian, the Japanese, the Hungarian one, because when they are able to explain what is the problem they have in their own language, you can discuss with them. So not only I worked with translators, but I also wrote a book about my experience in translation. This book is in a total form in Italian, but in English was published in two versions, Experiences in Translation and Mouse and Rat. So, I mean, the direct experience with translator was for me enormously important. And I am in a sort of polemic attitude toward many theorists of translation, who make enormous theories of translation, but never translated something. I had a triple experience. I translated only two books, but one was Exercice de Style of Queneau, which is a challenge, and the other was Sylvie of Gérard de Nerval. I worked with translators, and having worked in a publishing house, I had to control many translations. So this experience was fundamental also from a theoretical point of view. Once we were in a public debate with another writer, very, very successful writer. And I mentioned my relationship with the translators. And they said, "Oh, you are controlling your translations. I had never thought of that." if by chance he was writing in English, okay, he was a racist, thinking that all the rest of the mundo was absolutely unimportant. No, he was writing in a minor language. He had never thought about the problem of translation. He thought that it was a sort of Alta Vista-like process, mechanical one. So I realized it was he was an idiot. That's why I don't mention his name.
Yeah, please.
And then I reread his books, and I realized, yes, he was really an idiot.
Please.
Good evening.
I
was just wondering about translation. I was going to ask more or less the same question. Am I right to think that there is a translator in this numero zero as a character? And so do you build any conspiracies or any theories around the translation? How much is that a feature, part of...
You cannot tell all the stories of this world. You have to focus on something. So the fact of his activity as a translator was only an explanation of his failure as a student, but okay. It would have been another story. But that's a good idea.
And I wondered, your theory of translation seems to be mainly about creating the same effect for the new reader, the target reader of the new text. And in order to do that, you often have to change things to keep the deeper structure but change the surface. Are there any instances of that in this translation? Are there things that have been changed in order to create the same effects?
So, Claire is producer because he knows very well my writings. Mm. Now, I have always said that the problem of translation is to produce the same effect, which sometimes requires not to be literal. No? The most stupid example, a character, in order to show how much he is stupid, says a stupid joke. You cannot say the same joke in your language. You change the joke, provided you demonstrate he is stupid. Okay. Here, I don't have particular translation problems because the language is pretty plain. In all my novels, my language follows the story. I say, in poetry, verba tene res sequentur. First the words, and then in narrative, like Cicero said, rem tene verba sequentur. Had the real thing, and then the word will follow. So, the style of The Name of the Rose was the style of a medieval chronicler. The style of The Island of the Day Before was a Baroque style. In this sense, I had to use a sort of journalistic style, pretty simple. So there were few real problems we have discussed with the translators, obviously. But while in the other novels there were an enormous problem. Apropos of the effect, the Russian translator of The Name of the Rose, Yelena Kostyukovich, great translator. But with The Name of the Rose, they speak Latin. If I put Latin in Cyrillic, but even though I put it in Roman letters, so for a Russian, Latin doesn't evoke church and nothing. So I will use the old Slavonic ecclesiastic language. And I think she was right, because the effect was to give an idea of a theological, liturgical language. That's why I mean by keeping the effect, without, obviously, betraying the story. But I think one has the right not to be literal in order to create such a similarity, yes, in the effect.
Do you know the story of, there is a novel called Captain Corelli's Mandolin by Louis de Bernier, and it is set on a Greek island in the war. And the plot is, one of the plots is a British man parachutes in, but he doesn't know modern Greek, he only knows ancient Greek, because he has been to Eton and to Oxford, but he has never been to Greece. And obviously, it is a novel in English. So de Bernier had to think, how can I do this? So he makes the man talk in medieval English. So the Greek characters are speaking, you're reading, they're speaking in modern English. And this character is speaking like somebody from Gawain and the Green Knight. You know, this is quite a music way of
one, doing. Well, the problem is how to translate War and Peace in French. War and Peace starts with French, Russians who speak French. If you put it in French, there is no effect. If you are so stupid to do, as some translators do, footnote, en français dans le texte, that's worse. Yeah. But somebody told me that the French of those Russians is so bad that the French reader can understand is a sort of artificial language. In any way, it's a real problem. It's a real problem. I don't know how they can do it in Chinese.
That's very interesting.
Because they cannot put it in French.
Apparently, somebody said to me, Charlotte Bronte's novel, Villette, which is narrated in the first person, and it has a lot of French in, not translated, because Charlotte Bronte knew French, and the character is in Belgium. And so she uses a lot of French. And that there was a similar thing when it was translated into French, that her French is quite bad, apparently. Charlotte Bronte's French was not so good. So French people can tell the difference between the character's French and perhaps. Anyway.
Hello. I'd like to ask. I'd like to ask about your liking for the fake, and the fake becoming the truth, and whether that informed your decision to have a first-person narrator, which could be unreliable and therefore maybe fake.
I've lost that.
Yeah, is your
no, but
it's
still
fine. Well, it's a question about whether the narrator is an unreliable narrator, because if you like fakes, one interesting way of... tell me if I'm getting this wrong. One interesting way of making the fakery into the narrative is having a narrator who you don't always believe. Or
okay.
Is this an unreliable narrator?
No, the unreliable narrator is Baudolino.
Yes.
In Baudolino, in which at the end it's told that everything he told was probably unreliable. Yes. Here it seems to be a reliable narrator. But if you don't trust him, it's okay. Because the first intellectual lesson is not believe too much in what are you reading.
Okay, so you can have him unreliable if you like. You're licensed. Licensed by the author.
Because that I was
please.
Thank you.
But then we are opening another story. In narrative, obviously everything is told is unexistent, okay, even if the narrator looks as reliable. But you fare finta, you pretend to believe it. It's the suspension of disbelief of Coleridge. In this operation, you enter fatally in a sort of possible world which is not the real one, but you accept the idea that it is true. In the last essay of my Confessions of a Young Narrator, I deal with this point that was once suggested, why people cry about the fate of Anna Karenina or Werther, even though they know they didn't exist. That is not only a psychological problem. It's a narrative, it's a metaphysical problem. But I think you have to suspend your suspicion of unreliable, as Coleridge said.
Please.
Thank you. Professor Eco, I just wanted to get back to the book and ask in particular about the character of Maya. I'm glad that you said she's one of the best characters in the book. I just felt she was a little bit shoddily treated, and having her end up with such an older man made me...
The lady thinks she was badly,
shoddily treated
because she ended up...
She was often, I felt, not really heard, and she ended up with an older man.
She's a little bit
iffy, as we would say.
A bit iffy. But
that word? I am not responsible of the sexual choice of Maya.
I suppose my question...
Since at the beginning she too was a loser,
yes.
In a way she wins something.
Yes.
You know, it happened that somebody, an older idiot, there are many, wrote that I was anti-feminist because in the name of the rose there are no women except one. It's like to say if you tell a story about Nelson and these ships, you cannot mention women. There are no women there. But in other novel, for me the women are those who understand the truth. In the Foucault's Pendulum is Leah, who understand that everything is a hoax. And even there, I think that Maya understands the truth. And since she understands the truth, all the rest is secondary.
In fact, I wasn't making a feminist point.
You are simply saying that you wouldn't have a love affair with Colonna.
Oh, no. That was a bit of a cheap joke. I just wanted to ask... What was the inspiration behind a woman such as Maya, or a particular woman, or a type of women that populate or populated Italy in history, etc.?
This is a secret.
That was my question. Okay.
It's a secret. It's a secret. Yeah. Please.
I'm interested.
Sometimes I use women to make stories, but I don't tell about them.
Please.
I'm interested in the acceptance or failure to accept by your colleagues in philosophy and academia of your multiple talents. We heard how a room full of academics in Cambridge mistrusted you. Do you feel that's changed in the 35, 40 years since then?
But the story of Cambridge was told by Joe.
Yes, and maybe they didn't know him.
Maybe he's unreliable. I have not changed my ideas about a gynecologist. No.
But do you think that, have you found that academic colleagues have been a little suspicious of your work because you have pleased so many readers?
Listen, after I wrote my novels, I received 42 honorary degrees by different universities. It means that my colleagues are better than we believe.
Yeah.
Not before. After.
After.
What?
Yes, sorry. Where have we got to?
And 42 are those I have accepted. Yeah.
Please.
Hi, you really made me laugh about the readership of your newspaper. You said the average reader is 50 and doesn't read books. And nobody reads books, not even the authors or the reviewers. Is this something you really feel, or is you were just having a good laugh about the, you know, the proposed culture page that they don't want? In the newspaper,
I can't remember which character says this, but the people who read this newspaper, they want a culture page, but they don't read books or anything. So they don't want to... You mustn't treat them. You mustn't expect that read books. Is this a reality? Does this reflect what you think is...
And you also said that the reviewers of books probably haven't read the books either, which
and
was...
And the review... In your book, in here...
The reviews.
The reviewers have not read the books. No. And the readers of the newspaper...
Obviously, the reviewers don't read the books, so otherwise they wouldn't be reviewers. But no, the phenomenon was that some newspapers recognized their own portrait. And that was pretty embarrassing.
Yes.
Because if they were destroying the book, they would have demonstrated that the book was against them. So they spoke very well of the book, saying it is telling the story of somebody else.
Yes.
It really happened this way.
Like that thing that Jonathan Swift says, that satire is a mirror in which everyone sees every face except their own.
Or somebody else.
Anybody else? Yes.
Hi. When you edit your book, do you edit as you go, or do you write it, go back, do a first draft, second draft, third? I mean,
how do you edit it? Do you rewrite it as you go, or do you write it and then go back over it?
No. I go back at every page. But, you know, something happened in the story of a writer with the invention of the computer.
Yeah.
Because once we're writing by hand, maybe, then writing on the typewriter, then you corrected it, but you couldn't re-tape with a computer. You can do it continuously. Mm. And so invites you to a sort of critical attitude, maybe an exaggerated one, because if you correct too much, maybe you get wrong. Mm. But in any way, it happens that there are infinite corrections. And once I made also a lesson for philologists interested in reconstructing the story of the book through the manuscripts. And somebody says, oh, now it's impossible. Yeah. No, it becomes more difficult. What Contini, a great Italian critic, called La Critica degli Scartafacci. Cosa sono gli Scartafacci?
Papers you've thrown away.
Eh?
Yeah.
Ecco, the critique of the lost paper becomes more important with the computer. Suppose you're writing on the computer a text A, then you print it, then you correct it, then you reprint it. Apparently, you have three versions, the first one, the corrected one, and the new printed one. But in passing from the corrected one to the new printing, you introduce other corrections. So there is a ghost copy. The copies are four, not three, but one is lost. So it makes fascinating the future of philologists. They can produce more positions in the university for your
lots people. Lots of PhD, yeah. Yes.
Hi, sir.
Sorry, yes, for, yes, Matt, yes, okay. And then...
There are many theories about Hitler in Argentina, and now you're talking about Argentina again. Why Argentina and not other countries? Just to, you know, because they are colleagues.
Because it's history. It's a real history. First of all, remember that Brazil was allied with the British, French, and so that Argentina was a sort of free place. Or it is real history that maybe with the help of Vatican, many Nazi bosses went to Genova, and from Genova they shipped to Argentina. And Pribke was discovered there when the Israeli secret agent had to capture Eichmann. They found. So it's history.
Yeah.
I love very much Argentina, but that's history. Don't cry for me, Argentina.
Gentlemen, there.
Hello. The Name of the Rose came along in 1980. And it seems, I suppose, I wasn't quite around at the time, but it seems to have been an almost an overnight sensation, a global sensation. Where did it come from?
No. why
we're talking about the, he's asking about the name of the rose, yeah, which first published in Italian in 1980.
Yeah.
It became a huge worldwide sensation, and that was your first novel. So had you experimented with different themes and approaches to writing before you found The Name of the Rose, or was there something about the times that made The Name of the Rose capture people's imagination?
Yes, is the eternal question, why, practically? Yeah. Why? Because I have 10 different answers. And they are all true and all false. One is that approaching the age of 50, I was starting at the age of 48, you usually abandon your family and escape with a Cuban ballerina. I found more convenient, maybe for laziness, to write a novel. Second, probably I had my mentor when I presented my thesis, not the PhD, but the Laurea thesis, that at that time in Italy was an important thesis, because they were not the 3 years of a BA, but 4 years and maybe more, said, well, you made an excellent research. But usually, when you make a research by trial and error, when have you reached what you believe to be the right conclusions, usually a scholar should speak of the conclusions, not of the stages of the research. And I realized that I was doing as he said, but he was wrong. Because the very way to explain how a research works is to tell it as a criminal story, mm-hmm. with even by quoting the trials and errors. So I had always a narrative attitude. Even my essays have a sort of narrative structure. Then I was telling stories to my children, and at a certain point, my children grew up. And so, so for many reasons, in a way, I had this idea of telling a story without really realizing it. Until the moment, this is the answer number 5, a friend of mine who was working for a small publisher said, I had an idea to publish a short criminal stories, 100 pages and no more, written by non-novelist, sociologist. Would you like to? I said, no. First, I think I am unable to write the dialogues. Second, I tried to find an answer. If I had to write a story, it would be 500 pages long. It would take place in a medieval monastery. Mm. And she said, no, it's not what I am looking for. Ciao. I went home and then tried to write a list of names. It means that in my belly there was something going around since, I don't know, how many times. At that moment, a sort of click of mechanical resort, I don't know, made me conscious of the fact that I had to write a novel. Then there is the answer number 10. I can tell it only in Italian, mi è scappato di farla come scappa di fare la pipì.
So what does he mean? What's that?
It escaped to me like when you have to piss.
Oh, all right. Okay. I'm not sure that quite explains its international success, but
I don't tell you the other 5 or 6 answers because I don't remember all of them.
Please.
I'm sorry, I have not yet read your new book, and I will. I've purchased it here. I wanted to know, from what I've heard, how it's described. Do you think modern Italy has been more influenced by the grand conspiracy and plots of the fascist right of Italian history, or is modern Italy has been more shaped by the more little corruptions and venality that has really been in the Italian life for so many years?
If it had more influence,
which has been more influential, the big conspiracies or the small examples of day-to-day corruption? Yes, is that? Yeah.
That is one problem. I think that they are at the first glance two independent flows of events. But all the real conspiracies were done in order to render impossible to govern Italy. So if there were not all those kind of non stabilizzare,
instability.
No? Probably good government could have fought more efficiently the corruption.
Yeah.
Okay, because the corruption exists everywhere, in every country. But evidently, in America, if you don't pay taxes, you go to prison. It works. Yeah. It worked with Al Capone, for instance. So it works. With a strong government, you can only control a part of the corruption. Then it continued. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had the Lehman Brothers or those stories of bank corruption. But corruption is a sort of permanent sickness in a social body. But a strong government, all the Italian conspiracy collaborated in order to weaken every government. So there was a connection.
A connection. Okay. Where have we got to? Oh, yes, sir. Please.
In response to an earlier query...
Could you get the mic slightly
Don't
closer?
Whisper, please.
Yeah.
In response to an earlier query... Can you hear me now?
Yeah, just about.
You said that you got these 42 degrees after you had written these novels. They weren't given on the basis of your academic publications. So my question is... Did you get the degrees because the academics couldn't come to terms with the semiotics? Secondly, what gives you more pleasure, writing the novels or writing the academic work?
What is the,
okay, the
is,
first question?
The first I understood that. The second,
which
more,
gives you more pleasure, writing
no,
the novels
I have no,
or writing
no,
the
No answers. Work? There are two kinds of sexual affair with your text. For the first... I tell you a story. I am obliged in order to answer. It exists in America, a collection called The Library of Living Philosophers. There are books of 2,000 pages in which each philosopher makes a sort of autobiography. Then 25 authors write a paper, and the philosopher answers to every question. It started, I don't remember whether Dewey, but there were a volume devoted to Einstein, to Carnap. Well, it's better than a Nobel Prize. Due to the present intellectual crisis, they don't have anybody more, and they chose me. So the last volume will be on me. I am working on it. It takes... The one on Quine took 12 years because people didn't send the papers. Then they wanted bibliography extremely precise with the number of pages of every article. It's an ordeal. Anyway, it happens. I have not decided the structure of the authors have been chosen by the editors, not by me. The book is devoted to me as a philosopher. Some of the papers are dealing with my novels. It means that not me. I always believe that they were two different jobs. But for many readers, there is a strict interrelationship between my essays my novel. I don't know if this answers your question, but this is a matter of fact. They decide to do that, and I have to accept their interpretation.
Well, I think we've got time for one more question. You're bringing the curtain down, so, yes.
I was just very interested in whether you're conscious over the 35 years since The Name of the Rose came out as to whether readers' tastes and ways in which readers read and their expectations have changed.
Are you conscious in the 35 years since The Name of the Rose that the tastes and expectations of your readers might have changed?
Have an expectation of what?
I don't know. It's a gentleman's question. Well, perhaps they are used to reading Umberto. When we read The Name of the Rose, we had never read an Umberto Eco novel. And now you've read that, and then you read other Umberto Eco novels, and you know what an Umberto Eco novel is, you think. So maybe you're expecting certain things. I don't know if that's what you're...
After The Name of the Rose, the British publisher told me, why don't you make a sequel? Like Dumas, 20 years later. I said, no. Every story must be different. And every story is, for me, a different research. But for many readers, every of my stories tells always the same story, which seems to me very normal. An author is not a schizophrenic. Sometimes it is, but... So I don't know what the readers expect. I think that Barbara Cartland writes what the readers expect from her. I think that an author could write what the reader do not expect, because the problem is not to go towards their needs, but to change them, to produce the kind of reader you want for that story. So I try to do what the reader doesn't expect, and the reader say, you are always saying the same story. And I think that from Homer on, it's always the same curse.
Thanks.
Homer was one of my colleagues who spoke the old Greek.
I'm sorry, we haven't got time for any more questions. Thank you very much for your questions. And I'm sure you're going to do some signing now? Yeah? He'll sign. And can I just... I'm sure you'd want me to thank Umberto for everything.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.